Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. You can stream live with us or look for podcasts from prior shows under local programming, Your Financial Choices. Today is November 7th, 2018. The markets were up today, the Dow closing at 26,180, the NASDAQ at 7570, and the S&P at 2813. Our topic tonight is year-end tax planning. We are live, and we will take your questions. Lori C. is in the studio with us this evening, and we'll answer your calls and take your question and bring it into the studio to me. So we can't take live calls tonight on air, but we still can take your questions live with Lori C. So she'll write those down and bring them into the studio to me. We hope to have that rectified next week or so. So again, if you have questions, you can still call in and just give them to Lori, and she'll write them down and bring them in to me. And that number to call is 610-758-8810. That is 610-758-8810. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments, and while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I will do my best to answer them. Last week, I think I covered estate planning, kind of bringing the whole plan together, and I expect that that podcast is probably available on the website at wdiy.org or yourfinancialchoices.com as well. And October, we kind of talked about estate planning a couple different episodes. Tonight, I thought, why don't we start talking about year-end tax planning? I know we have 2 months left, but that's the point. We have 2 months left, so there still might be time to do a little bit of planning. And basically, I'm going to highlight some of the items that we would go over with clients when we're looking at a year-end tax planning review. I might not cover everything that we would talk about, but some of the bigger items and things that you have to consider in your own planning, possibly for 2018. But if you feel like you're good and all set for 2018, some of this may impact you for 2019 as well. So typically when we're working on taxes, we're almost working in three tax years at the same time. We usually look at the prior year, the current year, and the next year. You want to make sure everything is all working together really well. So typically, we would start when we're looking at income taxes. We would talk about filing status or your dependents. Have you had a change in filing status or dependents? Now, recall that with the tax reform, the dependents are going to have a little different, having children, dependents, is going to have a little bit of a different implication for you than it has in the past. We're not looking for those exemptions that we had in the past. Where dependents might make a difference is what kind of child tax credit we might get. So you'd want to understand if maybe a child is too old now or moved away, how is that going to change your tax implications if you, number one, we don't have those exemptions anymore. How would that impact your tax return? Filing status, affects our tax return and our tax rates. There's individual filing, which we call single. We have joint filings, which is married filing joint. You can have married filing separate. And you can have head of household filing statuses. And so someone might be single but have a child in the home that would qualify maybe as a dependent, which then therefore might qualify you for a head of household filing status. I do know that in 2018, I think it's going to be implemented in 2018, the IRS is asking preparers and signers of tax returns, and if you self-prepare, you're responsible for this then, to go through special steps to kind of verify and confirm that someone qualifies for that head of household filing status. There, I would imagine, be a lot of hiccups at the IRS when you have competing parents trying to file with this head of household status claiming a child when maybe you're not together anymore and one, the father or the mother are trying to file quickly to take advantage of claiming a child so they can get that better filing status. So the IRS is implementing further guidelines in confirming whether someone is allowed to actually claim that status. So we're looking at changes in filing status or dependents. It could be in the current year. It could be in the next year. If you filed one filing status last year and it's changing this year, you should have, if you have not already, reviewed what your tax situation might be with that change in filing status. You may not have enough withheld. You may have too much withheld. Sometimes people don't realize when you get married, if you're single and you make $50,000 and you get married and now your spouse makes $10,000, when you combine your income, it's just it could have different tax rates to it now. And one might not have had any withholdings on it because, $10,000, maybe you would not have had any income tax due on $10,000 of income. But when you combine it with $50,000 of a spouse's income, now you have $60,000. That could change your income tax obligation. All right. So changes in filing status can have a big impact. A lot of times, again, really broadly first here before we kind of go into a little bit more detail, one thing with the tax reform where we're going to see probably the biggest change is people itemizing their deductions. And I'm still amazed today that some people don't understand the concept that we used to have that was standard, or still have, standard deduction versus itemized deductions. So basically what the IRS has always said is everyone gets kind of this standard deduction. And that is to kind of make up for those kind of miscellaneous costs or expenses that we might have that, might not amount to, a significant value. All right. So standard deduction. And it used to be, let's pretend, and I don't even remember off the top of my head, I think married filing joint was like $12,700. There, I looked up in 2017. The married filing joint standard deduction was $12,700. But if I was someone who had a mortgage and I'm working and I had taxes that I paid, state and local taxes, and I had real estate taxes and I had charitable giving, and when I added all those up together, maybe they were $30,000. Well, if I'm married filing joint and I add up all these special taxes that the IRS let us deduct, then if it's more than our standard deduction, we would itemize. So if that was $30,000 and our standard deduction is $12,700, I'm obviously going to do itemizing. Well, what happened with tax reform is they raised the standard deduction. They doubled it. So now married filing joint standard deduction is $24,000. And it's a little bit more if you're over age 65. You get an extra $1,300 for each spouse that's over 65 or older. So if you have two that are 65 or older, it's like $26,600 standard deduction. That's pretty high. But then what they did on the itemized deduction side is they started taking some of the deductions away. So there's no longer miscellaneous itemized deductions that people can take. Some people had, investment interest or unreimbursed employee business expenses, their tax preparation, those are all gone. What they did still keep was the charitable contributions, the mortgage interest, but there's certain caps on the mortgage interest now, but assume you have, you know, the mortgage interest. And the tax deduction is now capped at $10,000, no matter what the filing status is. So if I had state and local taxes of $10,000 and real estate taxes of $6,000, and that helped me get over the threshold for filing, for itemizing, well, now it's capped at $10,000. They took away some of these other deductions. I might be only at $20,000 of itemized deductions. Well, comparing that to the standard, it's $24,000 versus $20,000. I'm going to take the standard deduction. But what some people don't realize is now I don't have the exemptions anymore. So you really have to review your own situation. So these are just some of the things we have to pay attention to. What you want to make sure is that you pay in as much tax as you owed in the prior year, or that you have some kind of a safe harbor so you don't owe penalties for underpayment of taxes. We'll talk more about this when we come back. If you have questions, you can still call in. Give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and bring it in to me. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Folk music, from folk classics to the Gaelic traditions of the British Isles, to bluegrass and old-time music of Appalachia, to the modern-day singer-songwriters telling the story of today's world. You'll find it all on WDIY. Listen and enjoy the wide variety of folk music every weekday evening, 7 to 9 p.m., just after NPR News headlines, and Sunday mornings at 11 a.m., here on WDIY.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert. If you have questions tonight, we're talking about year-end tax planning. Phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. Now, I was talking about filing status dependents, itemized deductions versus standard deduction. So as I mentioned, if you're one of those people who falls into the category of no longer itemizing, taking the standard deduction, but you're not going to have those exemptions you used to have, you might think, oh no, now I might owe a lot of taxes. Well, the other thing that happened is they lowered the tax rates for brackets and expanded the brackets. So for some people, it might offset, but we can't say that across the board or make a general comment about that. That's why you really have to kind of look at it for yourself. The caution here is that some people might have been used to their federal withholdings, whether it was through work or pension or Social Security or their IRA distributions. They might have been used to their withholdings covering their taxes that were due. And their taxes that were due might have applied to wages, that pension, that Social Security, that IRA I mentioned, but it might have also covered the taxes that they would incur on investment income. So I have clients that might have, let's say, $10,000 of investment income. Well, you don't have federal withholdings on your investment income. So there might be people who rely on those withholdings they have on some of those other sources of income to cover the taxes due on the investment income. And that's where you might fall short, because the withholding tables changed for 2018. For the payroll, they were kind of implemented in your employee paychecks, sometime, I think February, March. So they might have been withholding higher amounts at the beginning of the year. Then when they implemented the new tax schedules, they dropped the withholdings based on those new employer withholding tables. So your employer might not be withholding at the same rate they were before. The same thing might happen with a pension. So you have to be careful about the withholdings and what they're covering. So that's the case where you're going to standard deduction. But you might say, well, you know, is that it for me? I'm just either standard deduction, I'm not itemizing anymore. Well, maybe you're someone who, if we were to add up the expenses that you would have or ordinarily be able to take on your Schedule A itemized deductions, like the taxes, maybe your real estate taxes and your state and local taxes, they might be over $10,000, but the cap is $10,000. So we have that, $10,000. Your married filing joint, the standard deduction is $24,000. Boy, you'd have to have $14,000 more of expenses in order to be even eligible to itemize. Let's pretend your mortgage interest is $14,000. Well, the $10,000 real estate taxes, the $14,000 mortgage interest, we're at $24,000. Are we going to be able to itemize? Well, do you have charitable contributions? Well, if I have charitable contributions of $2,000, now my itemized deductions are $26,000. I only really get the benefit of itemizing over the standard deduction by $2,000. It's still something, but it's not really that much. So this is where the planning comes in. If you're someone who knows that you have this big mortgage interest right now, or combination of mortgage interest, real estate taxes, and charitable giving, is there a way to bunch some of these deductions into 1 year to get you more bang for your buck, that such that in a subsequent year, you don't have as much expenses, but then you get the advantage of the standard deduction? Typically, what we're talking about here is when we have people who are charitably inclined, maybe to the tune of $5,000 a year or $10,000 a year, and have the means to accelerate their charitable giving into 1 year. And that would allow a bigger deduction currently. We would want to do this if we thought you were going to have a lot of taxable income. So it takes some planning. And again, everyone is different. And that's why you kind of have to look at your situation and not rely on just what I'm saying here generally. This is about awareness, bringing some awareness to you to help you figure out some of this. I had some calls come in, some questions, and I'm going to get to these as quickly as I can. Donna from Allentown. The standard deduction cap, filing single, retired, 79 years old. Her income is pension and Social Security. So, Donna, your standard deduction, if you're single, is $12,000. Because you're over 79, you get an extra $1,300. So your standard deduction is $13,300. That's it. Standard deduction, no personal exemption. You mentioned your income is pension and Social Security. Here's where this can get a little tricky, because Social Security is taxable based on your other income. If you had no other income but Social Security, your Social Security is not taxable. If there's a formula that you have to go through, a worksheet, where you actually say half of the Social Security plus the pension equals what amount as a single person, you reduce it by a certain dollar amount, and a crazy, crazy calculation to see how much of your Social Security is going to be taxed. So it all depends on your situation. When you say pension, I'm assuming that's like a monthly pension. Donna, if you also receive distributions from an IRA, if you have a 401k or an IRA, 401k this doesn't apply to, but if you're getting required minimum distributions out of an IRA, another way for you to save would, if you were charitably inclined, is instead of writing checks out of your checkbook to your favorite charity, you take the money out of your IRA. That's called a qualified charitable distribution. You bring that income off your tax return. And in situations where we have people with Social Security, sometimes by bringing the IRA distribution down by virtue of making a charitable contribution out of your IRA, and you can only do this if you're 70 and a half, sometimes we bring down that income that goes into that circular calculation to see how much your Social Security is taxable. So, Don, I know you only asked about your standard deduction, and I went on and on about your pension, but not sure all your Social Security would be taxable. My guess is maybe only part of it would be. Not sure. Depends on how big your pension is. If you're a teacher, maybe 85% of your Social Security would be taxed. It all depends. So you want to go through those calculations. Let me see if I can do one more question before our next break. Mario from Reading, married with one daughter, filing with daughter, included for some time now as married. Would it be better to file single with one child? You're married with one daughter, and your daughter is your dependent. So I assume you're married filing joint, and that is going to probably generally most often be a much better filing status than filing single with one child. Because if you're married and living in the same household, you can't file the head of household filing status. So it would be single, not head of household. So I'm generally, Mario, the married filing joint status is better. Sometimes in the software, if you enter everything accordingly, you know, taxpayer, spouse, taxpayer, spouse, taxpayer, spouse, sometimes the software you're using or your tax preparer can tell you if a married filing status is better. I have rarely seen it better. So married filing joint is probably good. If you have a daughter and she's young and you have college on the horizon at all, Mario, you might want to think about setting up a college savings account. That gives you a deduction on your Pennsylvania return to the extent of your the amount that you contribute to it. So the other thing I want to mention, which I'll talk about as I go through the show, you're getting, depending on her age, there's a huge child tax credit this year, depending on her age, that might benefit you. And that child tax credit's pretty big and available to a lot more people this year. So they took away the exemption, but they gave this big child tax credit. It's like $2,000, and that's dollar for dollar against tax. It's really big. So, Mario, hopefully you can catch the rest of the show. We had one more question from Carolyn. Carolyn, I'll answer that question when I come back from this next break. Love the questions. 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. Lots of calls coming in. Love the questions. While I am live tonight, I cannot take live calls, but you can certainly still call in live and talk to Lori C. And she's quickly writing all the questions down and bringing them into the studio. The number to call in is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. Mario, I just wanted to end with one thing. I quickly double-checked the age. The child tax credit for 2018 is going to be $2,000 for children under age 17. So that is a really good deal. I think the income limitation is like $400,000 or something. So people with adjusted gross income of $400,000 or less are going to qualify for this $2,000 tax credit for children under age 17. So if Mario, if your daughter is under that age, that is a great tax credit. Carolyn from Sailorsburg called. Husband is eligible for Medicare in February, which means that he's going to be age 65. Should she keep him on her insurance? So he's probably retired. Should she keep him on her insurance plan, which is the principal or the primary insurance? Carolyn, sometimes what happens, you want to check with your employer and the health plan that you have, because sometimes the group plan for your employer will actually require the spouse to go on Medicare. So you still may be able to cover them as the secondary insurance, but sometimes the employer plans will require the spouse to go on Medicare. There's Medicare Part A and Medicare Part B. Medicare Part A is the hospital insurance. Sometimes they require that one. Sometimes they might require both A and B, and the B is the like doctors and, you know, medical services and things like that. They may require you to have the spouse go on that automatically. So you want to check that. If there is a cost to Medicare Part B. Medicare Part B, just off the top of my head, I think it's like $132 a month, depending on how you signed up and when you signed up. So let's say it's $132 a month. Your employer plan, if they don't require you to go on, or they don't require your spouse to go on Medicare, I would weigh this. Does it cost more to go on Medicare? Does it cost more to keep him on your plan as a family plan? So you want to check that out. So number one, are you required to have him go on Medicare? Sometimes they'll require Medicare Part A. Sometimes they might require you to go on both, but you might still be able to have them on as the secondary insurance. So you want to talk to your benefits people about what you can do. If he goes on Medicare and goes off your employer plan, it's not just the Part B that you'd have to pay for, the $132 a month. You then would also have to look for a supplemental insurance. And the supplemental insurance may have, you know, typically has an additional cost. It depends on what plan you go into under on a Medicare supplemental plan. We had Dan Banks on the show probably a couple months ago. So there's a podcast from a couple months ago, I think, Daniel Banks from Silvercrest Insurance, who came on and talked about Medicare and making sure you understand the options. Before you do apply to Medicare, there's a window. They usually like you to kind of look at it like 90 days ahead of time. I actually think, Carolyn, as I'm talking about this, if your husband's collecting Social Security, I think they are automatically signed up for Medicare Part A, automatically. And you might want to check on that as well. So kind of coordinate that. All right. I hope that helped a little bit. But I think you're going to need to talk to the benefits people at work, too, to see what your options are. And then if you do go for your own plan, you're going to still have to have a supplemental plan. So you want to make sure the cost between Medicare Part B and the supplemental, is it going to be less than what it would be through your employer, and kind of navigate it that way. We had Chitur from Allentown. His wife, he's married, has a wife, and an autistic 19-year-old son. Can he continue to claim his son as a dependent, and for how long? If you're providing more than half your if your son is not providing more than half of his own support, so if your son is not providing more than half of his own support, and he doesn't make over a certain amount of dollars, you could, and you know, the relationship, and there's, you know, a little chart you can go through. I'm guessing you probably could still claim him as your dependent. If he's a student, because he's 19, if he's a student, you can still claim him despite the income limitation. So the income limitation, it's probably about $4,000. So if he doesn't make more than that and he's 20, you could still claim him. But if he's a student, he could make $10,000 and you could still claim him there. They, as long as he's not providing more than half of his own support. So that's the little test there. And for how long? Again, once they're over a certain age, there's other requirements. But if he's not making more than that dollar amount, and Social Security does not count, I think in the gross income test, there's a relationship test, a citizenship test, a gross income test, an age test, and there's little nuances to all of these, Chitar. So I it's hard for me to tell you exactly, but you may still be able to claim. Oh, here it goes. He gets a second part of the question. He gets supplemental Social Security. How do they treat that? Does it get reported as income on the tax return? His supplemental Social Security is his own, so you don't have to report that on your return. The Social Security does not come into the gross income test. So I think as long as he's not earning $4,000, and again, that's a ballpark number, you'd have to, you know, check further. I don't have that detail at my fingertips. The Social Security doesn't come into that. But if you're still providing more than half his support and he's not providing more than half of his own support, you still may be able to get him. So this is just general information. It's hard for me to give you specific advice without knowing all of the, well, I can't do that on air anyway. I can't give you specific advice, but those are kind of the guidelines. Support test, gross income test, relationship test, the age test, and he can't file a joint return, I think. So you want to go through those, but you may still be able to claim them, I'm thinking. All right. So I hope that helped. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. I still have another minute, I guess, before my end of break here. But we were talking about different ways that you can maybe bunch expenses to take advantage of itemizing. Typically, when I talk to clients about that, if they have the means and they're philanthropic, they could bunch their charitable contributions. And you might say, but well, I pay $5,000 to the church every year. I don't want to give them $50,000 today. Well, that's where you use other means, such as a donor advised fund. You can use a donor advised fund, dump all the money into it in 1 year, get the deduction in the current year. Might be cash. You could use appreciated securities. You get the deduction today, and then you make the distribution to the charity out of that fund each year. You don't get to count that as another deduction because you've already taken the deduction, but that's one way to kind of bunch the deductions and get it all at once, and makes more sense. You can also consider using appreciated securities. That is securities that you've held more than a year. This is typically a good way to maybe pare down your portfolio when you're doing rebalancing. You have some equities that have really increased in value. That could be a good target to transfer to a nonprofit. You get the deduction for the fair market value, and you don't have to pay the tax on the gain. So, ways to do some planning and do some itemizing and still take advantage of itemizing in these circumstances. All right, folks, we're at the halfway point. If you have questions, call in. Give your question to Lori C. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
This is WDIY at 630. Your current temperature is 57. Thursday is going to be sunny with a high near 52. Thursday night, a slight chance of rain after 1, low around 38. Friday, high near 49. Friday night, low around 39. Saturday, mostly sunny with a high near 45. Saturday night, mostly clear with a low around 29. And on Veterans Day on Sunday, sunny with a high near 44. Now back to your financial choices with Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Shandi. I want to go back for a minute to, and I hope your name is Chitar from Allentown. I wanted to quickly just go over a couple tests for that dependency. Qualifying child. Qualifying child is one who meets the following six tests: relationship, age, residency, support, joint return, and then there's tiebreakers. I'm assuming you're married filing joint, so I'm not going to worry about the tiebreaker. Relationship, the child must be the taxpayer's son. Boom, you've checked that off. Age test, the child must be either under age 19 at the end of the year and younger than the taxpayer, or under age 24 at the end of the year, a full-time student and younger than the taxpayer. So a full-time student is one who's enrolled in a full-time program. Any age, if totally and personally permanently disabled. So I'm not sure if your son has been deemed totally and permanently disabled. Residency, the child must have the same principal residence as the taxpayer for more than half the tax year. Support test, the child cannot provide more over half of his own support. So there might be a number of tests there that qualify your child. What happens once they reach over those ages, if they're no longer a student, they're 19 or older, no longer a student, then they may be eligible as your dependent under something called qualifying relative. And that's where the gross income test comes in. So the person must have less than $4,050 in 2017. It might be a little higher in 2018. And gross income does not include income earned by a totally and permanently disabled person at, you know, different organizations or government agency that provides special instruction. And to be excluded, the income must be incidental to medical care. So there's a number of little nuances to that. So you see, it's not always as easy as it might sound when someone calls in with a question. So you guys, we're talking about tax planning tonight, year-end tax planning. The phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. So you know how we talked about kind of bunching expenses, maybe bunching those charitable giving expenses, or maybe your real estate taxes are only $4,000, but you have great investment income and you pay a lot in state and local tax or state taxes for that investment income. Well, maybe you want to make all your payments in 1 year for your estimated taxes. Sometimes you can make the fourth quarter in the next year. Maybe you want to do it in the current year, and that might, take you over the threshold. So there's different strategies you can use for that. Let's see what else. When we talk about tax planning, one thing that we're looking at, too, at the end of the year here is for people who are 70 and a half or older. I mentioned this earlier, you can do something called a qualified charitable distribution. So instead of taking part of your RMD or your required minimum distribution from the IRA, paying taxes on it, putting it in the bank, and then writing a check to your favorite charity, you can have your custodian write the check to charity directly. So let's pretend my required minimum distribution is $10,000. And I want to give $6,000 to my church. I can ask the custodian to write a check to the church for $6,000. I deliver it. I get a receipt. And then at tax time, I have a 1099-R document saying I took $10,000 out of my IRA. And then I tell my tax preparer, but $6,000 went to my favorite charity. So guess how much income I report on my return? $4,000, the difference. So $10,000 required minimum distribution, less $6,000 to my charity. I only have to report $4,000. There's a little code on page one of my return called QCD that lets the IRS know I made a qualified charitable distribution from my IRA. That part's not taxable. That's really, really, really great for people who are charitably inclined, who really don't have a lot of income on their return, and that by lowering that amount that we report, we might also lower the amount of our Social Security that's taxable. So I have a number of people that happens to. It's a great tax planning strategy using your required minimum distribution. People often ask, do I have to give the whole required minimum distribution? No, you can do it in part. Generally, what I tell people, you don't want to do $50, $50, $50. It would drive your custodian crazy. Most of them have a limit on that. So generally, if you know you're going to give $5,000 to your favorite charity for the year, let's just do one check. That's just efficient. So keep that in mind. That's a great benefit that is allowed to you still get a tax benefit. And that's, for people who don't itemize anymore, you don't have enough to itemize. But if you're charitably inclined, you're 70 and a half, it's great to do. So up to the, you can do any part of the required minimum distribution. You can do more than the required minimum distribution, but you cannot do more than $100,000. All right. If you're someone who works and maybe you're self-employed, you may want to defer income if you think you're going to have a high tax year this year. Maybe you're going to retire next year. Maybe you want to, defer some of that income into your lower income year. So you can maybe not send out that invoice. Maybe defer some of the sales you might have. If you are in business, maybe there's a piece of equipment you were going to buy, and maybe your income's really high this year, but you don't think it's going to be very high next year. Well, you could buy that equipment and depreciate it and lower your income. We also would want to review with folks if they have investments. What kind of investment income are you looking at? Do you have unexpected capital gains, capital gain distributions? Do you have mutual funds that are going to pay a lot in capital gains? Sometimes those capital gain distributions don't come out till the end of the year. But maybe you didn't have that in a prior year or you weren't paying attention to it. You want to understand what's going on in your investment portfolio. And when I'm talking about investment portfolio, I'm talking about your individual account or your joint account. I'm not talking about your retirement account. Because what happens in your retirement account doesn't impact your tax return until you take money out of your retirement account. Or make a contribution to your 401k. That'll lower your wages. But other than that, the activity within the retirement account is not reportable as it is for individual or joint accounts. So individual and joint accounts, you have dividends, maybe some interest income, maybe capital gain distributions and or long-term capital gains, short-term capital gains, long-term capital losses, short-term capital losses. You want to know what the activity in your investment account is in those accounts to see how they're going to impact your tax return. Maybe there's losses that are unrealized, meaning you haven't sold it yet. But if you want to get an extra little benefit on your tax return, you could harvest losses. That's what we call it. We could go in and harvest some losses, generate a sale, recognize that loss, take that loss on your tax return, save you a little bit of taxes. And then what you do with the proceeds from that sale, you might go into a similar asset that hopefully will recover, or maybe you need some of the money for your, you know, expenditures. So whatever you do with that money, you can do whatever you want, but you've kind of realized that loss and that might help on your tax return. People who have self-employment income, big changes for 2018, big changes. There's something called a qualified business income deduction. It's called Section 199A. If you're under certain income thresholds, it's going to be a nice little deduction for you. It's not a tax credit. It's not a deduction off your Schedule C. It's not a deduction off your self-employment income. It's a deduction off your Page 1 income. Lowers your Page 1 income up to 20% if your income is under a certain threshold. So if you're self-employed and you're married filing joint, if your Page 1 income, not your self-employment income, your Page 1 income is under $315,000, you will qualify for this business deduction of 20% of your business income. So if I made $20,000, 20% of that is $4,000. That would be my deduction from Page 1 income. If my adjusted gross income on Page 1 is under that 315. If you're single, it's 157.5. So a lot of people, if you are self-employed, a lot of people are under these thresholds. So you could expect to get this extra little kind of bonus of this 20% deduction. So that might help a lot of people. If you're over those thresholds, there's a phase out range. So from 315 to 415, there's a phase out for married filing joint. If you're over $415,000, there's a different calculation for what that deduction might be. And it depends on what kind of service business you have or what kind of business you have. Certain professions won't get the deduction at all over these certain thresholds. Other people might get the deduction, but it might not be 20%. It's a crazy formula. It all depends. So just be aware if you're self-employed, don't count on that big, huge deduction unless you've crunched the numbers and understand what it's going to be. If you are self-employed or have any, you know, partnership kind of income, S-Corp kind of income, self-employed income that may qualify for these credits, you need to get in with your tax preparer and have them run some of these numbers to see where it's going to land for you, because you can't count your chickens before they're hatched. You don't know if it's really going to apply to you. Don't make assumptions. You want to run the numbers, because here's the other thing. What if you could still do a little planning before year end to help you get these deductions? Maybe you're over the $315,000. Maybe you have that piece of equipment you could buy. And if you buy it, now you're under the threshold. You see, this is tax planning. That's what you want to talk to your preparer about. That's really probably the most complicated change in the tax law for business owners and for preparers at a broad level for us. I'm sure there's more complicated tax reform that's going to affect big corporations. But for, you know, the typical tax preparer and taxpayer, that is probably going to be the most complicated one to make sure we understand it and you're getting the full benefit of it. When you're looking at tax planning, also, don't forget about new streams of income. You heard me mention earlier about Social Security and that sometimes it's taxable. Some people think or don't think that Social Security is taxable. They just think, oh, you know, it's not taxable. And they didn't realize all of a sudden they're doing their tax return that maybe they have a pension, maybe they have investment income, maybe they're taking money out of an IRA. and they didn't realize, oh, my Social Security now is going to be taxable. So you want to make sure you understand what kind of additional income streams you have for 2018, whether it's wages, Social Security, IRAs, required minimum distributions, pension, alimony, or gambling winnings. Gambling winnings is another one that people sometimes forget about. They think, oh, well, you know, I have these gambling losses. That's going to offset it. It doesn't work like that. The gambling winnings show up on page one. The gambling losses used to be a miscellaneous itemized deduction on page two. I mean, on Schedule A. Well, if you didn't itemize, you didn't get it. And if most people aren't itemizing anymore, you're not going to get that benefit. And I think that's even gone away. So gambling losses, not something to count on offsetting those winnings. Alimony is something that's changing. Traditionally, if someone was paying alimony, they could deduct it on the tax return. If someone was receiving alimony, they would report it as income. If you don't have an agreement by the end of the year, either a property settlement agreement or something written, that is no longer going to be the case. Alimony going forward after December 31st, 2018 will not be deductible by the person paying it and will not be reportable by the person receiving it. So that was pretty nice for people who were higher income taxpayers paying the alimony. And for the people who were getting it, you could, you know, make an IRA contribution based on that alimony. So that's going to be gone. So you may need to run into your attorneys and talk about whether or not it makes sense to get divorced before year end, or at least have some agreement put in place. Folks, we have about 15 minutes left. I've appreciated the calls tonight. It's a big help. Talking nonstop for an hour starts to wear you down a little bit. Hopefully we'll have our live calling machine set up next week. But for tonight, you can still call in with questions. Just give them to Lori C. She'll write them down and bring them in to me. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
The many choices and real voices on WDIY are made possible with support from our generous, sustaining members. An automatic monthly gift of $10 on your credit card is an easy way to become a WDIY member and support the programs you love. Set up your monthly sustaining membership gift today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 7 or visit wdiy.org. Thank you.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices, and we're talking about year-end tax planning. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're not going to be able to cover everything tonight. I'm trying to hit on a few topics of consideration. If you have questions, the lines are open. You can give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and bring it in to me. I can't take any live calls on air tonight, but we can still take your questions. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. Have, you know, 10, 12, 13 minutes left here. When we're talking about year-end tax planning, my favorite part of tax planning and preparing taxes are the tax credits that people can get. I mentioned earlier to our caller who had the young daughter, the child tax credit, which doubled. It was used to be $1,000. Now it's $2,000. It's for a child under age 17. But here's the big bonus for people, that they increased the adjusted gross income of the people that this applies to. It used to be much lower. I don't know it off the top of my head. Much, much lower. It's now $400,000. So if you're married filing joint and your income's $400,000 or lower, you can qualify for this child tax credit of $2,000 for children under age 17. No matter, like, if you have three kids, you'd get $6,000. It's up to the tax. So remember, it's a tax credit. So if my income tax is $3,000, I have one, let's say, dependent child that qualifies for this. That's $2,000. Then my net of that, I would owe $1,000. But if my tax was only $1,000 and my child tax credit is $2,000, then it only offsets that $1,000. Now, there are other types of refundable credits, but in my story here, I'm just talking about the child tax credits offsetting your income tax due. If you're single, the threshold is $200,000. Another great credit is the dependent care credit. It's $500. The dependent care credit is something else. I think someone wrote a note about dependent care credit. The child tax credit, that's what I'm thinking. The child tax credit is when you have children, I think under age 12 in child care. You may be able to use a flexible spending account through work if you've put money into a flexible spending account. That's the best because you're saving income tax off, you know, your payroll right there. So that's great. Flexible spending account for dependent care is great. But you can't double dip on that. But if your child care expenses are more than what you put into the flexible spending account, you still might qualify for additional child tax care. So again, this is a little complicated, but let's pretend I have flexible spending at work and I put $2,500 of in my flexible spending account for my child care, but my child care cost $3,000. Well, if I only did $2,500 through payroll, that extra $500 of child care cost I have could still be used for an additional child care tax credit on my tax return. It's a form 2441. So don't miss out on that. Just because you use flexible spending, you might think that's it and you're done with it, but you want to make sure you understand if you have child care expenses that exceed what you've put in your flexible spending account, you still may be entitled to an additional tax credit on your tax return for the child care credit. I think the new thing that I see this note on was dependent care credit is $500 per dependent. And I think there was something for children who are over age 70, like maybe a college student who's still in your household, depending on how old they are. They were going to give you a little extra credit for those kids too. But I don't know that off the top of my head. So I'm just going to stop there. There might be something else available to you there.